You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we force Canada Land publisher Jesse Brown to face journalistic accountability on the North State, explain how Mark Carney and Alberta Premier Daniel Smith are fulfilling Big Oil's wish list on The Breach Show, look back at the life of iconic socialist J.S. Woodsworth on the prospective journal's Social Democrats of the North, and argue that the rush for Indigenous identity policies in academia is causing harm on Red Eye. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. Launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise bi-weekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo. Like in this recent episode where Scott sits down for a tough conversation about accountability with Canada Land founder Jesse Brown. Now, here's the show.
Hello, I'm just jumping in to remind listeners that the North State will be taking questions for a Q&A episode up until December 12th. Link in the show notes if you'd like to submit your question. The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This podcast is about news media criticism in Canada. Inevitably, that focus gets it compared to another, far more established avenue for news media criticism, Canada Land. I've written about its decline in quality over the past 2 years and even released a monologue last week about the subject. With the release of their latest series, What Is Happening Here?, a podcast exploring anti-Semitism in Canada since the October 7th attacks, Jesse Brown, founder, editor, and publisher, tries to prove that he still has the juice, as it were. Spoiler alert, I have made it clear why I don't think that is the case. But at the end of my episode last week, I let Jesse know that if he wanted to face my criticisms head on, he could reach out to me. He did. What you're about to hear is something unique. Criticisms that I don't think have been posed to Jesse so publicly, so directly. Usually, if you want to hear his voice for nearly an hour, you'd have to wait for it. But this is the North State. Jesse Brown, editor, publisher, and host at Canada Land. Welcome to the North State.
How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing all right. I guess my first question is, why are you here? I know that you, obviously, with your interview with Neuer, you said you would go on anyone's podcast, but why are you here with me right now?
Well, yeah, I am kind of trying to make time for anybody who wants to talk with me about the new series, but I'm really happy to be here with you. I was happy to learn of what you're doing over like the decade plus that I've been doing this. We get this frequent response from people that considered us progressive and then feel betrayed, you know, that Canada Land, this isn't, that media criticism is great, but this isn't a real progressive podcast. And I'm like, yes, I know. I never said it was a progressive podcast. It would be great if there was somebody who was pursuing media criticism from a progressive point of view. It'd be great if there were tons of media critics from different political points of view, different ways of coming at the media.
So you think I'm kind of filling that void from the progressive side?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the network you're on is an explicitly progressive network, and that is your project.
So, yeah, I just wanted to make sure that was your read of it. But yes,
that's my read of it, and so the more the merrier. And you know, because there's always this frustration of like, Canada's media critic. And I'm like, no one's stopping anybody else from doing this. So I wanted to welcome you. I was happy to become a paid supporter of your show. And I want to wish you well with the project. I think we need more of this stuff out there.
Thank you. I actually, it's funny, I forget to mention out paid supporters. So I'm doing a Q&A soon. I'm going to do it at the top, and you're definitely going to be on the list there. But to get right into it, you found out this podcast, as far as I can understand, from me doing a very, you know, critical read of Canada Land and the new podcast. So, you know, this could be an interview that could get to some heated moments, but I wanted to start it off because I think we both agree on certain things. So, I mean, not necessarily a concession, but like, okay, we both agree on this. Like, I'll start. I do believe anti-Semitism is a huge problem in Canada. It's a huge problem across the world. And currently where we're standing, newsrooms are incapable of handling the subject appropriately. So obviously you don't know me as well as I may know you, but maybe something we can both agree on.
I do agree on that. Why do you think newsrooms are having trouble with it?
Well, I think that, quite frankly, there's not a cohesive understanding of the history and the impacts. And I think it's a systemic problem. That's kind of what this podcast does. But what do you think we can both agree on?
All of that sounds right to me. I have more to say about it, as I do about most things. I think that the fact that so many Jews have left Canadian newsrooms, representation is an issue. And but generally, I agree. I think that there's just a very strange hesitancy to talk about it in a way that I don't think applies to any other group. So in addition to the fact that we have this surge of anti-Semitism, there's sort of this compounded discrimination in that it's dealt with differently. The discourse around it is itself anti-Semitic in that it's in a different category and there's a double standard.
We're going to talk about some of this. Obviously, it comes up in your new series, and I think that's going to be primarily the focus of this interview. But as I've mentioned before, and as has been kind of floating around, there's a criticism of a statistic that you use. I believe it is that a Jew in Canada is 9 times more likely to be a victim of a hate crime than a Jew in the U.S. Now, when you were interviewed by Noor Azria on Canada Land, you did address this, and I do have the quote here, but obviously you're here, so you stand by that? Do you have any further extrapolation of it?
Yeah, I think it's a fairly asinine critique, because I think to fairly represent the criticism, it would be, well, this is not exactly apples to apples, because hate crime is defined, you know, two different countries, they have two different versions of what hate crime is in the law. There are differences in how police enforce hate crime laws, and there are differences in police reporting. So you can't possibly compare the two. And that's valid up to a point. But by that logic, you can't compare crime statistics, or really any statistics, between two different countries ever. So, you know, it's sort of like to be assumed that if I talk about, you know, shoplifting or jaywalking crime statistics between two countries, yeah, it's the crime is defined differently, enforcement's different, but we routinely compare these things. That being said, it would be a substantive critique if that were enough to account for this 9-time statistic. If that were true, if this alarming statistic that Jews are so much more likely to be the victims of a hate crime was only because of these differences in classification and reporting, then that would also be true for every other minority. There would be a similar disparity. There is Jews, and only Jews are that much more likely, by the comparison of these two statistics, to be subjected to a hate crime. I think the first thing in journalism is just transparency, for me to say, this is what I did. I looked at the Canadian hate crime statistics, police reported hate crimes. This is not B'nai B'rith or anything. This is police deeming it worthy of being on that list, which is actually quite a rigorous process. And I'm comparing that to the FBI's data. And those two data sets I link to, and people can say, oh, you know, well, that's apples and oranges, or that's not exactly apples and apples, but it's still useful and instructive. People have that information. They can come to their own conclusions, but I stand by it, and I think it's a solid point of reference.
I want to push back on that, because, you know, when you say that there is an increase in reported hate crimes against Jewish people in Canada, that's true. If you just look year over year, especially the jump from 2022 to 2023, it's there. You can say that Jewish people are definitely the most targeted in reported hate crimes, but I don't quite accept your critique that it's asinine and that you could extrapolate it to other groups. I mean, I reached out to Statistics Canada because I was very curious about their take on it, and they said, quote, while Statistics Canada publishes police-related hate crime data targeting Jewish people within Canada, we cannot directly compare it to U.S. data due to different reporting practices and methodologies. Now, you've discussed that, obviously, but you do attribute it to Statistics Canada, and they said this statement cannot be attributed to Statistics Canada. So I'm curious as to why that is very central in your series when, like I just discussed, you could say that Jewish people are the most targeted in reported crimes. You could say that there's been a huge spike. So I'm just curious as to why that is so central.
Well, to look at, it's not accurate what you're saying. In the episode itself, I give a full and detailed attribution. In the episode itself, have you listened to the series, by the way?
Yes, I've listened to all three that have been released so far. In the trailer, you say, according to Statistics Canada, though.
Right. So there is a difference between the episode where I have more room to cite my sources and the trailer. So there's a shorthand in the trailer where I reference it. Like, I think maybe you got a point. I could say based on Statistics Canada, rather than according to Statistics Canada, it's a little bit, you know.
Did you talk to a statistician?
I don't want to call you. Yeah, I did. I don't want to call you pedantic. That would be rude. But I think that it's understood that, you know, things get summarized when you're doing a promo. But where you have the room to actually like give the full, you know, show your work is a good rule for journalism. That's in the episode. So there's no obfuscation
but
here.
Jesse, it's all pedantic. I wouldn't say Jesse Brown said this if you didn't say it, even if, you know, maybe it was similar. Or you could extrapolate from it. That's not accurate. So I think, you know, maybe pedantic is correct, but that's an important thing, especially when you're talking about such a heavy topic. Like, you want to be confident in what you say and how you say it and be like, yes, I talked to Statistics Canada and they said this. So I'm just curious there.
Well, I think that you know, if I were to have said, and maybe it wouldn't take too much more time. So let me just think about this, because you have like actually like rigid 30-second and 60-second allotments for some of these promo materials. I say, according to Statistics Canada, and it would be much more accurate to say, based on a comparison of Statistics Canada, that's too long.
An analysis done with Statistics Canada reporting.
Based on a comparison of Statistics Canada to FBI police crime data, I think I knew that what I had to say and what I was reporting in the show was going to be so hard for people to hear who, I'm not talking about you here, but I knew that any point of vulnerability or any thread was going to get attacked. And I think that it's a fun, because there are people who have very strangely, because a lot of people who are like, you know, committed anti-racists and people who've done a lot of work against racism, you know, it's one thing to not care or not respond or not give Jews the same consideration you give other groups when they say that they're being attacked and they're under fire. But to make it your business to try to refute, to argue with Jews every time something comes up, and I'm not talking about me here, like when I say with Jews, I'm talking about what the consensus position of the community is, and really actively try to say that wasn't racism, that wasn't anti-Semitism, you're
okay,
wrong.
But no, like, but we're getting
back. Let me just finish the point. Okay. Like this guy, Jeremy Appel, he was online once, he's a podcaster, I think he's on your network, and he, like, there was a video of a guy, like, it was an anti-Zionist protester on a bus, and he was, like, yelling at these Jews. And he was, and Jeremy was coming to the guy's defense saying, he's saying goof, not Jews. And then there was a further video clip that came out where he says it again, and it's very clear that he's saying Jews, and Jeremy had to retract it. And he congratulated himself for correcting himself there. I was like, what is going on here where this guy has this champion who's trying to twist this into an attack on goofs?
Sorry.
Or something. You know,
like, okay, you're saying that people will take any excuse to exonerate your anti-Semitism? Is that what you're trying to say?
Let me be really clear.
Of course.
A lot of people who are invested in the anti-Zionist movement have taken the position that discussion of anti-Semitism is both false, exaggerated, hysterical, and malicious. that it is intended to obscure or give permission for Israel, that it has something to do with that. And as such, it's become like, a moral obligation for people to talk over Jews and refute very solid reporting on anti-Semitism.
Just to be clear, you admitted that it was incorrect to attribute it to Statistics Canada. And, you know, I would agree with you. I think that, you know, in this sphere, a lot of people would take something like this and discount the whole thing. Like the first episode you have, there are stories of anti-Semitism that are truly harrowing. But it wouldn't it be better to just be as accurate as possible in the data? Because some actors who are being in bad faith will take that as an excuse to dismiss real stories.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The North State. Find out host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with author and analyst Seth Klein to break down how Prime Minister Mark Carney and Alberta Premier Daniel Smith fulfilling Big Oil's wish list. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. Prime Minister Mark Carney wants more oil production in Canada, and in partnership with Alberta Premier Daniel Smith, he's been busy getting rid of environmental protections and checks on greenhouse gas emissions. A new memorandum of understanding between Alberta and the federal Liberals paves the way, the legal way, for a potential new oil pipeline. There's still no company offering to build the pipeline. There's no proposed route, and many First Nations and the government of British Columbia are strongly opposed. A new pipeline may never be built, but the impact of Carney's shift in climate policy will be significant. Here to discuss this with me is Seth Klein, a board member at BC Policy Solutions, team lead and director of strategy with the Climate Emergency Unit, a five-year project of the David Suzuki Institute that's about to wind down, and the author of A Good War: Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. Hey, Seth.
Hi, Desmond. Good to be with you.
So, Seth, Mark Carney did campaign during the 2025 election on turning Canada into what he called an energy superpower. So in some ways, I think that his support for a potential new pipeline is not that much of a surprise. But the way that his government is going about it, namely negotiating with Alberta, but not with First Nations, not with British Columbia, and rolling back a whole host of Trudeau-era measures on greenhouse gas emissions, this is the part that seems to be surprising and even angering many people. So what do you make of this pipeline plan with Alberta, I guess, just right off the bat?
Well, first of all, I think you're probably right that it isn't surprising, or maybe shouldn't be surprising, and yet it has been surprising. I think for a lot of people in the climate movement, they're experiencing a bit of whiplash. I would say you're right that Carney talked about making us an energy superpower, but he was coy about it and did it in a way that I think his campaign successfully managed to be a kind of political Rorschach test, where everyone could see what they were looking for in there. And for a lot of people in the climate movement, they thought Carney was their guy. They certainly don't think that anymore. I think there's definitely some feelings of betrayal, and I think this new memorandum of understanding with Alberta was really the last straw. The budget a few weeks prior was also pretty definitive, a budget that clearly put the interest of fossil fuel companies ahead of climate.
Well, there's also a lot going on. There's conversations about a new pipeline. There's conversations about existing pipeline capacity. There's conversations about bringing in data centers and needing the energy to power that. He's really thrown a whole bunch of things into the mix here all at the same time.
I mean, much of the media attention has been about the pipelines piece, and we should talk about that for sure. But actually, as you dig into the agreement, and the more it sinks in, the more it becomes clear that this is much more than just about pipelines. I would say that what we got is, in fact, an entirely new energy framework, certainly between the federal government and Alberta, but actually with ripples across the rest of the country. We got massive concessions to Alberta in the oil patch on climate policy that effectively leaves the whole of the last 10-year Liberal government approach on climate in shatters. And as you were just intimating, there's a lot there on electricity and EI as well.
Let's start with what Danielle Smith has been saying for the last several months, which is that she's identified a bunch of regulations and rules and laws, and she calls them the 9 bad laws. And there are these federal regulations and rules, which in her mind have been hindering increased oil production in Canada. I mean, to be fair to her, not just in her mind, I think that in many ways, the Trudeau government did put a lot of pieces in place to try and limit greenhouse gas emissions. Carney now has signaled a willingness to remove or alter the majority of these 9 rules, regulations, what have you, that Danielle Smith singled out as being a problem for oil production. So we should talk about a few of those first.
Yeah.
And I want to talk first about the proposed cap on oil and gas emissions that the Carney government, Seth, has just said, we're not doing that anymore. What's your reaction?
Yeah. Well, the writing was on the wall on that one. So first of all, just you're right that Danielle Smith basically has gotten everything she wanted here. And whether or not a pipeline ever happens, she has effectively already won. The oil patch has already won. That's why that very same day, you know, Mark Carney got 2 standing ovations at the Calgary Chamber of Commerce, which is not something anyone would have expected, because they could see it. They'd already won. The budget a few weeks prior had already signaled that the oil and gas emissions cap was going to be gone. And just to say, let's be clear, the climate movement has spent years working on this, and it's effectively all for naught. It's not going to happen. But that was one of many of the immediate concessions. So that cap is gone. This was also signaled in the budget, but the federal prohibitions on greenwashing, they're backing away of that. They wanted that gone. It was a change that was made a couple of years ago under the Competition Act. And it basically says, and it wasn't just targeted to fossil fuel companies, it basically said that any company that is making environmental claims has to be able to substantiate what they're saying. You know, they can't just basically, you know, BS their claims. They have to be able to back it up, or put another way, you can't just lie. And so there was this revision made to the Competition Act, and it now appears that the oil patch hated it. It was a significant reform that when it was instituted, the next day, the Pathways Alliance, the main mouthpiece of the oil patch in Canada, scrubbed their entire webpage and their social media feeds, realizing that they were vulnerable to a legal claim, that they were making all kinds of claims about oil and gas that they could not back up. So they didn't like this rule, and they are effectively being told that, okay, we hear you. Alberta and the oil patch also got a 5-year delay on the methane regulations. I know this is very technical, but this is one of the more significant things the federal government was doing to actually lower emissions, is that methane needed to be reduced by 75% by 2030. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. It mostly comes from the oil and gas sector. Alberta got a 5-year delay on that. The big carve-out that Alberta got was on the clean electricity regulations. They're basically told that they can continue to generate electricity by burning gas. And also, Danielle Smith has been very actively blocking new renewables. And now she can just keep doing that. There's no imperative for her to rethink that, because now they're allowed to continue burning gas. They also got an important concession on carbon capture and storage. One of the juiciest tax credits that the federal government has offered is a tax credit for investments to do carbon capture and storage. But until a week ago, they couldn't use it for what's called enhanced oil recovery. Basically, when they capture all of this carbon from their own emissions, the idea is, and of course, this is all technically very iffy, they have to basically bury it deep underground, get rid of it. But they couldn't use it to basically pump more oil out of the ground. Well, now they can. Now they're saying that you can actually get the tax credit and use it for that, which effectively wipes out the whole net zero purported claim of the thing if you're now going to use it to extract even more oil.
Okay, so weakened mandate on carbon capture and storage, weaker rules about clean electricity. We have the loss of carbon emissions cap. But to substitute, we were told, for all of this, it was kind of a claim that was made, don't worry, because there's also a price on carbon in Canada, and it's going up for Alberta. So we're going to be able to actually make up a lot of the concessions that we're giving on emissions in other places by increasing the price of carbon. So what do you make of that argument, that whatever we're losing in these other areas that you're listing off, that a higher price for people who pollute will kind of balance things out?
And so, first of all, to be clear, this is the one piece that Carney has said he gets and supports, is an industrial carbon price. So one of the very first things that Carney did is scrap the consumer carbon price. But he said he remains committed to not only keeping but enhancing the industrial carbon price. And under the current regulations, that price was supposed to increase to $170 a ton by 2030, and it it's approaching 100 now.
Yeah, it increases gradually every year.
Exactly.
Climate plan.
Exactly. Yes. And so those who defend this deal with Alberta have said, well, okay, we scrapped all of these regulations, but in exchange, we now have Alberta's agreement to move forward on the industrial carbon price. And done well, an industrial carbon price is effective. I mean, it's one of the things that is currently making a difference. But in fact, this is a concession too. It was already the law of the land that the industrial carbon price needed to be $170 a ton. That was a federal backstop. It's one of the areas where the Supreme Court of Canada had already clearly said that it is federal jurisdiction to go ahead and do this with or without the agreement of the provinces. But under the agreement, they defer to let Alberta run their own industrial carbon price plan, but it's no longer going to escalate to $170 a ton. It's only now going to increase to $130 a ton. So it's backtracking there. And the timeline is delayed to some new timeline yet to be determined. So that's what we got in exchange for all of these other concessions. And for those who say, oh, well, you know, it's effective, it's a known thing. I mean, interestingly, and, this has become more apparent in the last few days. I first heard it on the National from Althea Raj. There is this unpublished report circulating from Environment and Climate Change Canada, where they tried to estimate, well, what would the industrial carbon price need to be if it were to offset all of the greenhouse gas emission reductions we've now forfeited by getting rid of all of these other things. And their estimate was it would need to be $400 a ton, nowhere close to the new limit of 130. So this too actually is a major capitulation.
I believe I heard Chantal Hébert saying that if the government had wanted to publish the analysis that you just cited of $400 a ton needed versus the 130 that Alberta actually is getting, if the government had wanted to put that in the MOU to show people, they could have, but they chose not to, probably because it doesn't look very good when you're talking about climate change, greenhouse gas emissions, and trying to meet our Paris Climate Accord agreements.
I think it's worth saying, too, because there's this whole risk of ripple now across the rest of the country. But the fact that Alberta has now got a carve out for its own arrangement when it comes to the clean electricity regulations, the fact that they're getting their own rules when it comes to the industrial carbon price, just means that other provinces, Ontario, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, they're all going to start lining up to say, me too. And, you know, this is very reminiscent to what happened, the death of the consumer carbon price. Because to my mind, if you had to put a time stamp on the death of the consumer carbon price, it's when, under pressure, the Trudeau government announced a carve out for oil in Atlantic Canada.
For home.
And in that one move, I mean, that is going to go down in history as one of the dumbest political moves. The floodgates open, and suddenly the whole logic of carbon pricing started to come into question, and everything unraveled from that point.
There's a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and